From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. We're following all of the developing news out of Washington today. Behind closed doors, members of Congress are hearing from the inspector general who labeled a whistleblower's complaint urgent because it alleged presidential abuse of power in a phone call with the leader of Ukraine. And the White House has said it would send a letter demanding that House Democrats hold a vote on impeachment before it turns over more information to them about that call.
And today, the president, who showed flashes of anger this week over the mounting impeachment inquiry, said there was no quid pro quo in newly released text messages. Those messages between U.S. diplomats appear to show the top Trump administration officials pressuring Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden as a condition of winning presidential meetings and military aid. President Trump saw it differently.
I'm only interested in corruption. I don't care about politics. I don't care about Biden's politics. I never thought Biden was going to win. To be honest, I picked somebody else a long time ago, and we'll see what happens.
Let's bring in our Friday Politics Roundtable. We've got Aisha Roscoe, NPR White House reporter. Hi, Aisha.
Hello.
And Chad Bergram, senior Capitol Hill producer for Fox News. Chad, good to speak with you.
Hi there.
And
thanks for having me.
Yeah, sure. And let's start with you, Chad. A string of headlines this week has just been completely ceaseless. What was the most important thing that you learned this week?
Well, I think that the thing that we haven't seen yet might be the most important thing, the fact that there's going to be this letter to the Speaker of the House from the administration saying we're not going to comply with any of your demands. You know, there was a deadline that the committee chairs, the triumvirate of committee chairs that are looking into impeachment here, that had set for today, that they were going to issue subpoenas today. The other thing here is that Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, was supposed to comply with another set of subpoenas for documents. And the fact that the administration is saying, look, you know, the fact that you have not approved a formal process on the floor to set up an impeachment inquiry, we're not going to comply.
Chad, why do they want that? Why is it important that they have a full vote?
The Constitution is pretty vague on this. Article 1, Section 2 says the House shall have the sole power of impeachment. Nancy Pelosi says she doesn't need it. What Republicans are trying to do is use this as a weaponized vote against Democrats from swing districts to say, look, you voted to start an impeachment inquiry and maybe target them in the 2020 election. That's an effort there to sideline that. And they're saying they're not going to play ball unless they get that. And we don't think they
would
play ball anyway.
Yeah, Chad, Pelosi has said that for decades, impeachment investigations have frequently been conducted without a full vote. But I want to talk a little bit about these text messages. And Aisha, let's go through them really quickly. One of the most notable is an exchange between two American diplomats. One of them says, quote, I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign. The other response is the president has been crystal clear, no quid pro quo of any kind. That diplomat then suggests the two talk rather than text. There's no specific mention of Joe Biden or his son Hunter in these text messages, but I want to know from you what's been the consensus. Is this evidence of quid pro quo or not?
Well, it would probably depend on who you ask, but whatever it is, it doesn't look great for this administration. So when you have someone, a respected top diplomat in this area, saying it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with a political campaign, that's the type of text that you don't want being sent within your administration. Like, that just looks bad. No matter what party or what have you, the fact that this is someone, that this was a concern that someone within this administration had, makes it seem as if that whistleblower complaint has some relevance, and that what the whistleblower was, the concerns that he was raising, were also being reflected within members of the administration.
Chad, I want to get your response in on this as well.
Well, that's why it's so important to hear from the Inspector General for the Intelligence Community, Mike Atkinson, today. You know, he was in on the 19th of September. They brought him back in before the committee today, the Intelligence Committee, because, you know, he's the one who targeted this as urgent, and they haven't heard from him since. That's why this is so important. And you know, I think, you know, Aisha's right there. You know, the fact that there was concern, at least by somebody, in the case of Bill Taylor here, that says a lot. You know, this is why members of Congress, you know, from both parties are pretty serious about this, trying to get to the bottom of this. You know, something I think is important is to note how this investigation has shifted toward the Intelligence Committee. Adam Schiff appeared with Nancy Pelosi at her press conference this past week. And back when I was in college, I had two very good political science professors, Bill Jackson and Dan Jacobs at Miami of Ohio. And they were both Kremlinologists. And they talked about always watch at the May Day parade who is standing next to the general secretary, because that tells you a lot who's in power. And just the fact that Adam Schiff was there with Nancy Pelosi and not Jerry Nadler tells you a lot about the investigation. Now, we'll hear from Jerry Nadler again, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, down the road, because he will, in fact, have to write the articles of impeachment. But this goes into creating this case that's saying you're not complying with these requests for documents and testimony, and that could go into an obstruction of Congress article of impeachment. We had that in 1974 by the Judiciary Committee with respect to President Nixon.
On the issue of these text messages, Republican Jim Jordan doesn't think they reveal anything. I want to play this. Here he is on Fox News last night talking about the text messages and yesterday's closed-door hearings where they first surfaced.
I hope every American gets a chance to read what took place in that room today, because when they do, they will see there is no quid pro quo. They will see exactly what President Trump and President Zelensky was going on between these two countries. And they'll see what a good ambassador, what a good diplomat Kurt Volker was, Ambassador Volker, and the people who worked with him.
Aisha, why do you think that Republicans and Democrats are reading the exact same text messages and they were in the exact same meeting, but they're interpreting it completely differently?
Well, I don't want to say that politics may be involved, but politics may be involved. This is D.C. But, look, Republicans are looking at this, and I'm sure that what they would want to focus on is that response text message that said you're incorrect about President Trump's intentions and that this was not some type of, you know, that they weren't pressuring Ukraine to conduct a political investigation. They want to focus on that text message, and Democrats are going to focus on the it's crazy that to withhold security assistance. So it's kind of what do you want to focus on when it comes to this? And Republicans right now are saying they are going to stick with the president and they are going to stick with this administration, and that they feel like that he didn't do anything inappropriate.
Let's talk a little bit about 2020. Last week, Joe Biden snapped at reporters asking about his Ukraine dealings. In Reno, Nevada on Wednesday, however, Biden took Trump head on. Let's listen.
Now, let me make something clear to Mr. Trump and his hatchet men and the special interests funding his attacks against me. I'm not going anywhere. You're not going to destroy me, and you're not going to destroy my family.
Chad, we've kind of been quiet on Biden, but has this past week raised serious questions about him or not?
Well, it raises questions because the president, you know, and we've heard this from the administration and the campaign before, that they thought that, you know, he might be the toughest to beat. They can, you know, portray this narrative of Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren as being too far left or socialist. But when you get to those mainstream Democrats or maybe suburban independent voters or women, that Biden might be the tough one. And so that's where some people is, you know, Aisha said, oh, my goodness, we're shocked. It's about politics, that people might say, all right, they're going in that direction. The problem here for every presidential candidate on the Democratic side of the aisle is that we are being consumed by impeachment right now, and it's hard to get any other message out and have any other narrative. And if you're not in that top tier right now, you're probably not going to break through, number one. Mm. Number two, this, you know, changes the contours of the race, and nobody knows what that means. Is it fatal for Biden just because President Trump and this whole milieu about impeachment is keeping this in the news every day? We just don't know. I mean, and I say that not as an off-the-cuff remark. People truly don't know where this is going to wind up.
Right. Well, and Aisha, let's take a look at those fundraising numbers that we're starting to see roll in. Joe Biden raised $15 million in the third quarter. Not good compared to his rivals anyways. This morning we hear that Elizabeth Warren raised almost $25 million. That's about what Bernie Sanders raised. Even Pete Buttigieg took in more than $19 million. So it looks like Biden's falling behind. We don't know if it's because of this, but he's certainly, at least in this category, losing a little bit ground.
Yeah, so this is, I mean, I would think that the Biden campaign would want to have better fundraising numbers than this. Certainly, these numbers coming out are helpful to Sanders, to Warren, to Buttigieg, who really hasn't been doing that great in the polls. To have that money, to have these resources behind them is very helpful at this point. But Biden, I think there is a real question of what's going to happen. Is this going to benefit him trying to go toe-to-toe with President Trump, him being the target of President Trump? Or is this idea that there could be some cloud over him because of his son's dealings in Ukraine and other places that people may say, you know what, let's leave that alone and let's focus on an Elizabeth Warren or a Bernie Sanders. Yeah. This could be a moment for them.
And one thing I just want to know, Bernie Sanders apparently will take part in the upcoming debate later this month, even though he had that heart procedure this week. So we'll see how he does. Ayesha Roscoe, NPR White House reporter, and Chad Pergram with Fox News. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
Hey, it's Maria Hinojosa, host of NPR's Latino USA, and this week we bring you a portrait of Isabel Allende.
My job as a writer, as an activist, as a philanthropist, as a feminist, is to create awareness and to say, okay, this is what I see.
It's Latino USA from NPR. Listen and subscribe now.
The city of Reno, Nevada, approved an ambitious plan this week to greenlight construction on 1,000 new homes in 120 days. It's part of a push to tackle the region's housing affordability crisis. For the next 4 months, Reno is offering to delay developers' fees on new buildings with 30 or more units. They're hoping to entice builders that are currently put off by high infrastructure costs. Reno's mayor, Hillary Sheevy, joins me now. Mayor, welcome.
Thank you.
The median home price in your city hit $420,000 earlier this year. It's one of the least affordable cities in the country relative to median income. So let's start there. What does the housing affordability crisis look like in your city?
Well, it's certainly been challenging. You know, I've always said with great success comes, you know, challenges, right? I mean, we've had a lot of growth. And you have to remember, we were one of the highest places in the country for foreclosure and unemployment during the recession, along with Florida. Obviously, there's been a lot of economic development. Tesla, Google, Apple, Amazon have all started to build and develop here. So, you know, for me, we can't wait. We need housing now. And that's where we came up with the initiative, 1,000 homes in 120 days.
Okay. And so let's talk about how it works. The city council approved it on Wednesday. Developers have 4 months to apply, 18 months to complete their projects once they're approved. What kind of incentives are you offering them?
So really, it's just deferring the sewer payments and infrastructure payments. Those will go on the back end. So a lot of times developers obviously have to get funding to get these projects going. But now, you know, they can sort of hold off on funding or use that funding in other areas to make these projects pencil.
So, and how much is that usually for them?
Well, it can be about $10,000 per unit, per door. So, and that's one of the requirements, is to come in with 30 units. But it really is about, you know, sort of supply and demand. And one of the things that we see, you know, in economics is then that way landlords can hold renters sort of hostage because they have no place to go. So supply and demand is really critical. One thing I'm really proud of this council of, we've really set the narrative of, when you come in with projects, one of the things we really want to see is workforce housing. And we also want to see affordable housing. And so we're also encouraging a mix of that. But, you know, this is a pilot project. So we're really going to look at the data and really encourage, you know, a percentage of affordable in all those projects so that those are sort of spread out throughout the city.
You say supply and demand, but if there was demand for 1,000 new homes, why wouldn't the builders respond to that and start making them?
Great question. Well, because we were one of the highest in foreclosures and unemployment, a lot of developers were burned in the recession. And so we're, you know, talking to many developers, they're just saying, you know, I'm just trying to kind of wait it out. It's, you know, not as affordable now because prices of land have gone up astronomically. And, you know, they're trying to get back in the market, but they're still scared because Reno was a very different economy in the recession.
A lot of people might say, hey, this is a handout. This is something, this is a freebie for big wealthy developers.
Well, you could say that, but here's the great part, is those fees will just go on the back end. So they're not getting any handouts. We will get every penny back. And if the project were to go what they call zombie projects, then we would put a lien on the property and own that.
A zombie meaning the project gets abandoned and there's pipes sticking out of the ground and there's 2x4s sort of not getting completed into a house. But that raises a good point. Are you concerned about sprawl?
So I think that's a great question because this is about building up and not out. And, you know, there is a large infrastructure ring that goes around the city and building with inside that. So you're not building sprawl. And these are also dedicated in areas that are, you know, opportunity zone areas. And one of the things, Reno was predominantly a gaming town. And in the recession, we really relied heavily on gaming. And that's also one of the things that really made it hard for us to sort of climb back is that you have to diversify your portfolio like you would when you make investments. And so that's what we kind of did. We looked at, you know, the city as a whole and said, hey, in order to survive another recession, we really need to diversify the kinds of industries that we're bringing in here and how we're building and, you know, focusing on more economic development with, you know, arts and culture and food and things that make cities great.
I was going to ask you, I'm trying to understand why housing prices are so expensive in Reno. I thought maybe it had something to do with the fact that you were so close to Lake Tahoe.
Well, I mean, Reno's really changed. We are very much like an Austin, Texas or Denver, Colorado. We've really focused on different types of economic development. I would say, too, you have to really look at what's happening in Silicon Valley. It's become so expensive for people to live in San Francisco. Medium home price there is $1.5 million. So we are seeing an influx of, you know, people coming from Northern California and tech companies. Tech companies really think about how much they can scale in an economy like Reno's. And Reno's backyard is absolutely sensational when you look at the outdoor climate that we have here. You know, some of the best skiing in the world's largest climbing wall, you know, in the country right here in downtown Reno. And then this incredible river that runs right through my city. And so we really have a lot to offer. And I think just, you know, part of that secret's out.
What is that, the Truckee River?
It is.
All right.
Bingo.
Reno Mayor Hillary Sheevy. Her idea is to build 1,000 new homes in the city in 120 days. Mayor, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
We're going to stay in Reno now for our next story about drones. UPS is the first company to win government approval to operate a nationwide fleet of drones to deliver packages at medical campuses across the country, moving it one step closer to making deliveries directly to consumers. There are a lot of regulatory obstacles to move through before UPS or any other operators can fill the skies with drones carrying things to your doorstep, which raises the question, how do you keep these flying machines from flying into each other? Or worse? Noah Glick from member station KUNR reports.
Thank you. I'm standing in the old historic post office building in downtown Reno, Nevada. A department store is now taking up the first floor, and upstairs there's a makeshift command center. It's the drone world's version of an air traffic control tower.
It's a secure facility. You can't get up there unless you have secure access.
That's Chris Wallach. He heads up the Nevada Institute for Autonomous Systems. It's an official drone testing partner with the Federal Aviation Administration. Today, Wallach is leading a variety of drone test flight missions.
So on this display here, this is the picture of the drone radar. So it picks up all the drones that are flying here.
Right now, drone users, including hobbyists, already have an air traffic system where they get approval before flying. But it's limited. Pilots must be able to see their drones at all times and can only operate them during daylight and not over people. Wallach and his team are working with NASA, the FAA, and private industry to develop a new platform to allow pilots to fly their drones out of their line of sight autonomously. That's something the Amazons of the world want.
We've got to bring our weather sensors up to get what we're showing in this area here.
Pointing to the screen, Wallach tells me this is the first time this system has been tested in urban environments. That's a big deal.
And we have multiple drones stacked up on different airspace segments, flying on top of each other in their own designated airspace.
In one test, a drone takes off from the roof of Reno City Hall and lands on a neighboring parking garage. In another, multiple drones fly simultaneously. The entire time, these machines are communicating back and forth with the system automatically.
This is kind of like the turning point for evolving the air traffic control network.
This project, known as the UTM system, will be for autonomous drones used by the military, government, and businesses. Ron Johnson is the project manager.
Right now, the idea is that pilots would upload a proposed flight plan. And as many pilots do this, the automatic system that we're developing will take in those proposed flight plans and make sure they don't conflict with anybody.
NASA estimates that 700,000 drones will be in the airspace by next year. Johnson says that's just too many for the FAA's current traffic management system to handle. He says the UTM system will be more automated and offer better insights.
The system will be able to provide information about who is flying. So if the John Q. Public's out there and they see a drone flying, the idea is that they would be able to go to an app or something like that and punch in some type of information about, where they're located, what's going on right now. And they would be able to see a list of whose drone that is.
That sounds fun, but the bottom line of this project is safety. Jay Merkel is with the FAA arm of the UTM project.
We're about to introduce a notice of proposed rulemaking to require all drones to have essentially a license plate number that local law enforcement could look up your license plate, determine who the operator is, and get in contact with that person quickly.
And Merkel says that could deter people from flying drones where they shouldn't fly them. This UTM system will eventually connect to other platforms, giving air traffic controllers a full picture of what's in the airspace. And as automated drones take to the skies beyond where their pilots can physically see them, Merkel says the machines need to be able to have some way to avoid running into buildings, power lines, or other drones.
So increasingly, we're looking at what technologies can replace the human doing that see and avoid function and ensure that that drone can stay out of the way of manned aircraft.
NASA is scheduled to finish developing the UTM platform later this year after more urban testing. The system will then go to the FAA for implementation, which Merkel says will get rolled out over time. For Here and Now, I'm Noah Glick.
And Noah's story comes to us from the Mountain West News Bureau.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
News from the Labor Department today that the U.S. economy added 136,000 new jobs in September, signaling that despite a dismal report about manufacturing earlier in the week, the U.S. economy remains relatively buoyant. Mike Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, it's good to speak with you.
You too, Peter.
And President Trump seemed pretty pleased with these numbers today. Let's listen.
The unemployment numbers just came out, 3.5% unemployment, and that is a tremendous number, the lowest in over 50 years.
And so that's the president. What are you taking away from this report?
Well, he is right. It is the lowest unemployment rate in 50 years, 1969. But the growth of the job market is clearly slowing down a bit. And you can't say that based on just one month's report like this. But if you look at the trend over the last 3 or 6 months, We're talking about 120 to 130,000 jobs on average added per month. That's actually like the slowest pace in more than 7 years. Huh. It's among the slowest pace since the last recession. But it is still growth. You know, in the recession, at the worst months of the recession, we were losing like 800,000 jobs. So it is enough to sort of knock that unemployment rate down a little bit more.
And we noticed the increase in worker pay was also down.
Yeah, a little bit lower, you know, after coming up to some of the highest levels in the of this business cycle, back down to below 3%. So not the most fantastic sign either.
Earlier this week, the Dow dropped 500 points following some news on manufacturing numbers that had a lot of people worried. They showed that manufacturing in this country is at its weakest level in 10 years. So help us understand, why are those numbers so low, but these job numbers don't seem to be as affected? I mean, again, as you say, we still added 136,000 jobs to the economy.
Right. So this sort of temperature of the manufacturing sector comes from a report by the Institute for Supply Management. And this is the second straight month that it's shown the manufacturing industries are actually shrinking. And the thing about manufacturing is it's only about 12% of the economy. The worry is that that weakness will spread into the much bigger services sector of the economy. And in fact, the ISM's report on service industries actually was very weak, still growing, but just barely, and falling to the lowest, weakest level in about 3 years. So it is starting to look like there is a little bit of contagion from manufacturing into the services sector. But it is still growing, and it hasn't quite been enough to really damage the job numbers too significantly.
There are so many reports out. There are so many statistics, and you can read them in so many different ways. It's hard to make sense of what yardstick we should be using to measure the health of this economy.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think you asked the question, you know, what was causing this weakness in manufacturing? The ISM report basically points at the trade tensions. And that is such a big question mark for the economy because it's something that could be resolved instantly or near instantly. And we just don't know if and when that will happen. So you look at these numbers and you think, well, they're weak now, but as soon as we reach a trade deal with China, they'll turn around. But it's just so many unknowns, so much uncertainty surrounding when that may be.
Yeah, the picture tends to evolve over time and become more clear. We'll see. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Peter.
Looking at a map of the United States, you could be forgiven for thinking only men live here. Writer Rebecca Solnit once said, "The peaks of our mountains sound like a board of directors on an old corporation." And nowhere is this manscaping more on display than in New York City, where there is the Lincoln Center, Columbus Circle, Rockefeller Center, to name a few. Meanwhile, the most prominent woman is the Statue of Liberty, which isn't even based on a real woman. But what if things were different? That's the question behind the City of Women map, which renames each of New York's 424 subway stops after famous women who have lived, worked, or reveled there. The map was created in 2016 by Rebecca Solnit and geographer Joshua Jelly Shapiro. And it just got an update. Joshua joins us now. Welcome.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Let's start off at the beginning. What was the inspiration behind this map?
Yes. Well, as you just remarked, it's interesting that we have the Statue of Liberty, of course, who's the sort of imaginary mm-hmm. woman. We have a statue of Alice in Wonderland in Central Park. And there are literally two or three others up until recently. There's a Sojourner Truth in Harlem and a Golda Meir in Midtown. But there are 200-plus statues of actual men who were real people and not imaginary people like Alice in Wonderland mm-hmm. and the Statue of Liberty. And I think that our map was also designed as a kind of intervention in a conversation that's really picked up steam in the last few years about gender and public space and the ways in which our names and our public spaces do honor and welcome a certain segment of the population and may not feel as welcoming to others.
An intervention. That's an interesting way to look at this. And looking at this map, Queens, for instance, there are some names that we all recognize, Lucy Liu, Margaret Sanger, but there are a lot of women we've never heard of. What was the process for selecting these women?
Yes, well, it really ran the gamut. I mean, a lot of it was just research in terms of looking into where various prominent people, entertainers and politicians and everyone else grew up or lived. But a lot of it was also just contacting local people and sort of community leaders and saying who in your area deserves to be recognized. And in Queens, for example, we also have women who may not be from there, but for example, out where the U.S. Open happens, we have stops named after Venus and Serena Williams, because when you're going to the tennis, why would we not celebrate these sort of iconic women in the life of that part of the city? You know, out the F line, we out in Bayside, we have Salt, Peppa, and Spinderella, the mighty members of Salt and Peppa, seminal hip-hop troupe from that part of the city.
Yep.
But no, it was really it, and we wanted it to be a mix. You know, we wanted to have the politicians, the, you know, Elizabeth Holtzmans or Bella Abzugs, but also absolutely entertainers, singers, community activists, curators. We have, you know, Thelma Golden of the Studio Museum of Harlem is on the new version. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, of course, is on the new version, has risen to prominence just in the last couple of years.
Your co-creator, Rebecca Solnit, has written about how powerful it is to feel represented in this intervention, really. She talked about even seeing herself as a lead in a movie makes her feel so charged up and powerful. And I was really thinking about, I go for walks with my son near the Rose Bowl here in L.A., and there's this life-size statue of soccer star Brandi Chastain. And each time we're there, my son, he's a little guy, he stops, he reads the plaque about her World Cup win, and then he stares at the statue. And it made me think about, not only for me, because seeing it makes me feel so proud, but for him, what this means for him, what it does to our subconscious to see women in this way, to see their names. And I'm curious about you as a guy, what it means for you, what this has opened up as you go through the world and look at our world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had a great time working on this map, researching the names, affixing them to the map of the subway, which, of course, is the map of New York City that New Yorkers know best. And it's fabulous fun now all the time to think about giving directions or getting around the city by saying, I'm going to get on the train at Grace Jones and get off at Yoko Ono. So that's one prosaic way that it's changed the way I get around the city. What it's also done is just in seeing the way that people respond to it and the way that young women in particular, but all people, young men as well, have responded to this map, it's shown me the sort of the power of representation and the ways in which it matters to see ourselves and people we recognize and admire recognized in public. And I didn't know when I started out with this project that it was necessarily going to have those impacts, but it has, and that's a powerful thing to have been a part of.
That's Joshua Jelly Shapiro, a writer and geographer whose updated City of Women map is being displayed at the New York Transit Museum. You can also view it at hereandnow.org. Joshua, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And now to Louisiana, where hundreds of workers learned this week that they're losing their jobs. That's because the Bayou Steel Plant in St. John the Baptist Parish is closing on November 30th. Governor John Bel Edwards blamed President Trump's steel tariffs because the plant relies on imported scrap metal. Let's hear what Parish President Natalie Rowbottom has to say. Natalie, welcome.
Good afternoon.
And it sounds like this announcement was a big surprise. What are you hearing from your workers? Were they expecting this?
Absolutely not. The workers were extremely surprised. They went into work on Monday morning after having had conversations the previous week about contract negotiations and a possible sale for the company. So they were definitely caught off guard.
Well, 376 employees will lose their jobs there. But do you know why? Is it related to the tariffs on steel, as your governor says it is?
You know, it's likely that is a component. The Bayou Steel Group has been having some trouble. And sometimes when there's an additional bump in the road, that can cripple a company. Obviously, it's one of two plants that were closed by Black Diamond, the other in Tennessee. And there's some relationship to tariffs because, you know, when the tariffs were initially passed, there was concern specifically for Bayou Steel.
Well, Governor Edwards, who is a Democrat, wrote a letter to President Trump last year. He said that retaliatory tariffs from China, Canada, Mexico, and the EU would harm Louisiana's ports also agricultural producers, natural gas facilities, and, of course, the steel industry there. Do you see any pain from the tariffs spreading to other places where you are, not just steel?
Well, we're hoping not, because the Port of South Louisiana is actually located in St. John the Baptist Parish, and it's the largest tonnage port in the Western Hemisphere. So we're hoping not to have more than one industry impacted. But of course, there's a neighboring steel mill in St. James Parish that, if this is a problem, then it's likely to affect the entire area.
We've reached out to the company. We have not heard back yet. But you have said in the past, as this developed, that you felt the company misled you, is walking out on workers. And the private equity firm that you referred to there that owns Bayou Steel said in a filing that the company was $100 million in debt. So how would you expect them to stay open? I mean, could they do anything else to keep the plant running?
Obviously, lots of industry have difficulty, but the fact that they did it without providing the 60-day notice is problematic. There's a WARN Act notice that should have been filed 60 days prior to the closure, and that just didn't take place. When speaking with some of the workers, they were misled because they were told they were in contract negotiations for a sale of the facility. And of course, many of our local vendors are impacted as well. And they're being left out in the cold without their money. Some as high as $650,000, $400,000. And those are just in the top 30 of a company that are owed by Bayou Steel.
I'm looking at other headlines today. There's a pretty good jobs report from the Labor Department. Unemployment across the country is at its lowest level since 1969. Of course, there are some warning signs. We're talking about one of them right now.
Right.
How does the economy feel where you are?
Typically, you know, it is doing well. So this came out of the blue with the 376 employees, but that doesn't account for the contract employees, the vendors, and the other scrap metal dealers that actually rely on Bayou Steel. Now, fortunately, we were quickly able to get with the state's Louisiana Workforce Commission and have a mobile unit and the Louisiana Workforce Commission office open and ready to go the next day. We received the letter on September 30th, the same time that the employees were told they no longer had jobs. But by the next morning at 8:30, the system was set up to assist many of them with resumes. So the system is working in that the office was set up to assist them with resume writing, applying for jobs. And of course, fortunately, there were two job fairs scheduled for yesterday. And we're working on one for the 10th of October, which is next week in St. John Parish, specifically for the Bayou Steel workers.
All right. That's St. John the Baptist Parish President Natalie Rowbottom speaking with us about the upcoming closure announced this week of the Bayou Steel plant. Natalie, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
The 10th season of Walking Dead starts on AMC this Sunday, and apparently it barely resembles the show when it first started 9 years ago. So many cast members have moved on, including its lead actor, Andrew Lincoln. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans has been watching. Hey, Eric.
Hi.
So I used to watch this show during the first few seasons, but so much, as I said, has changed. Hardly a single cast member from the beginning remains. Is it still fresh?
Well, I think that's the operative word, used to watch. I think a lot of people used to watch this show.
Yeah.
You know, to me, it feels like a show that has just been around a long time. And it is hard for shows with long tenures to retain their narrative steam, because if you were somebody who watched the show when you were watching it early in the show's tenure, a lot of those actors are gone now. And so you may not even recognize the cast if you started watching the show now.
I can't even really imagine the show without Andrew Lincoln. So that means that I am very much out of date. There's also Danai Gurira. She's the character Michonne. And we have a clip of her talking to a fellow survivor early in season 10.
We have to choose to be the good guys, even when it's hard. And the minute that we start to question that, and we lose sight of it, that's when the answer to that question starts to change.
AMC announced that this will be Gurira's last season, just as season 9 was Andrew Lincoln's last. She's a big name in her own right these days. She made a splash in Marvel's Black Panther. How damaging is her departure going to be? She's like one of the last familiar faces.
Right. And if you watch, I've seen the first three episodes of the new season that starts on Sunday, and she's a big part of those episodes. She's a major leader amongst the survivors of the zombie apocalypse that we care about. You know, it's interesting, the clip that we played where Michonne is talking about we have to choose to be the good guys. I think that's also a problem that The Walking Dead has, and maybe its biggest problem is that the theme of the show is pretty basic.
Yeah.
And yet again, we have another character stepping forward and telling us the theme of the show that's been enacting that theme for 10 seasons. Mm-hmm. So I think they're constantly reliving this overarching theme, which is how do you retain your humanity in an inhumane situation?
You're right. It's why I stopped watching the show. I could only take it for so long. I'm thinking, if I were in this society, could I even survive after, you know, all of this? But The Walking Dead really has had a remarkable run. What are some highlights that you do love from this show for you?
Well, there's a lot of great highlights. I think even when the show started, seeing Andrew Lincoln's character, he's injured in a shooting, goes into a coma. And when he comes out of the coma, the zombie apocalypse has kind of taken over the world. He eventually makes his way to Atlanta, where he discovers another key character named Glenn. And we even have a clip of that. This is one of my favorite moments in the show, where Andrew Lincoln's character has been trapped by a bunch of, they call them walkers, they don't call them zombies on the show, and then Glenn tries to help save him. So let's listen to the clip.
I got a Beretta with one clip, 15 rounds.
Make them count. Jump off the right side of the tank, keep going in that direction. There's an alley up the street, maybe 50 yards. Be there.
Hey, what's your name?
Have you been listening? You're running out of time.
Yeah, and so, you know, folks will remember Glenn turned out to be a really key character played by Stephen Young.
Absolutely.
And them coming together was a key moment for the show, where our initial cast of characters, the hardy band of survivors that we would follow through so much of the show, came together as Rick began to meet Glenn and brought him into contact with other people.
Okay, so we're now headed into the latest season. Do you think this premise will still have life? Will it still live on beyond this season?
Well, certainly AMC hopes it will. I mean, you know, it's interesting. I mean, just as the show has started to lose steam, and it's been through a lot of changes, not only did Andrew Lincoln leave, who was the star who played Rick Grimes, Lauren Cohan, another who plays another key character, Maggie, left the show, but her character hasn't been written out. So that leaves some hope among fans that maybe she'll return at some point. And the guy who was the showrunner when the show was at its peak, Scott Gimple, actually got promoted into this job where he oversees a bunch of different projects that are based on the Walking Dead world. And so there's going to be a theatrical movie that Andrew Lincoln is going to star in, because fans may remember his character, Rick Grimes, wasn't killed. He was sort of kidnapped in a way. And so his story may continue some other way. There's a spinoff called Fear the Walking Dead that's on AMC now. But there's also another spinoff that is centered on young people who have grown up in the zombie apocalypse and have never known a world where walkers haven't dominated the earth. So they're trying to break off pieces of this franchise and use it to prop up AMC at a time when the show is losing a lot of steam and a lot of fans like yourself have stopped watching it. And so I think that's going to be a huge challenge for them going forward.
Well, for now, The Walking Dead still lives on, and I might actually check it out. You kind of said some things that have me interested in this latest season. Thank you so much. That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans.
All right. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.